Hello, this is Mark Shanton, welcoming you to Theatre Voice's regular monthly critical roundup. Two of our regular panellists, Charles Spencer of the Daily Telegraph and Matt Wolfe of the International Herald Tribune, are joined today by Libby Purvis of The Times, whom we newly welcomed to the regular reviewing ranks last year when she took over from the long-serving Benedict Nightingale, and I'd like to welcome to Theatre Voice today. So before we tackle this month's roundup, I'd just like to begin by asking Libby how you're finding the job so far. You came to theatre reviewing after a long career in broadcasting and journalism, so it's a bit different, isn't it?
It is, yes, and it's completely addictive. It's like crack. I still have to write some ordinary journalism, as it were, and reminding myself to bother with the news pages is really difficult. And the big problem is you can't be in more than two places at once. You could be in two places at once if you go to a matinee and then an evening.
And you have done that.
There are things I miss that other people review, and then I get all frustrated because I read about them. I think, oh, that sort of feeds into the whole picture of what's going on. And so then I go on my day off. So it's a bit unhealthy, really.
How many shows do you review a week now?
The contract is four. I have been known to do six.
Theatre Record, which, as you know, collects all our reviews, in January published, and it's a slow month, published 55 reviews for 55 shows. So we always have the task of having far more shows to cover than is possible to do so.
It is, and I don't like it when I'm just sort of locked in as the chief, because it's sort of Old Vic, Young Vic, West End, National, and so on, because I like to get out on the fringe, and I like to get out of town, and I've been out of town a lot, from Scarborough to Plymouth, and I think that's quite important to get out a lot, but you can't be everywhere. It's very frustrating.
Indeed. Well, we've got a bumper edition today, and we're going to begin with new plays and musicals, followed in the second part by a series of revivals. Let's begin our new work section with Betty Blue Eyes, a new musical based on another old film, the 1984 Alan Bennett scripted film comedy A Private Function. It's produced by the maestro of modern British musicals, Cameron McIntosh, in his first new, fully original new musical in over a decade, directed by Richard Eyre and choreographed by Stephen Mear, and has an original score by Stiles and Drew, whose work McIntosh has long championed. The book is by American writers Ron Cowan and Daniel Lipman. Much is being made of the timing of its opening. It's set in the austerity Britain of 1947 and revolves around the royal wedding of Princess Elizabeth and Prince Philip, following the small-town politics of a dinner party being given in celebration of it, for which a pig is being illegally reared to be served at. Charlie, is it a welcome serving now that we're about to celebrate another royal wedding?
Oh, I mean, I think Cameron must be rubbing his hands with glee, really. I mean, it couldn't be better timing. The absolute whole mood of the original film, and indeed of this production, though the production, it seems to me, is much warmer than the film, is austerity and a royal wedding, and so it's bang on the money. And it's a really terrific show. I wasn't sure how it was going to go, because I didn't like the film very much. I thought it had a sort of coldness about it, which is unusual for Alan Bennett. I mean, it had some very funny moments in it, but it was a sort of slightly creepy quality and a sort of rather malevolent quality in the way he viewed the characters. But this has got tremendous warmth. And the thing that really cheered me up is we've all probably known Stiles and Drew for 25 years, and here they are. And at last, they've got a show that's entirely their own, that's going to be, I would think, a big smash hit. They started, I suppose, more than 25 years ago with Just Sir at the Trike. They had a musical here at the National called Honk, and they wrote some additional music for Mary Poppins, but they've been grafting so hard and have written a lot of good songs, but never had the show to go with them, and this absolutely is, it seems to me.
And Cameron McIntosh has definitely kept the faith of them. I mean, that's the thing, you need a strong producer behind you to write new musicals, and that's what he's done. Of course, it's austerity Britain that comes at a price, £59.50 a ticket. And I think there's a certain irony to that. I actually thought that Billy Elliot was far superior. I know, Matt, you have a different view.
Well, people who listen to this program will know my history of Billy Elliot, so leaving that aside, I think this is a far superior show to Billy Elliot. For one thing, it's got a proper score, which Billy Elliot doesn't particularly have, and also there's a sense of, as Charlie's indicated, Stiles and Drew somehow coming good with this piece. You know, you often wait for artists to arrive at a point of fruition. For instance, Jez Butterworth with Jerusalem, sort of taking his career to a new plateau, a new dimension. And I think that's what Stiles and Drew have done here. From the very beginning of the overture, which is this fabulously jazzy up-tempo overture, and then there's an entre-act, and then there's even a finale ultimo, it feels like the best old-fashioned musical that you never sort of experienced 40 years ago, and yet it's been treated with 21st century finesse.
Yeah, it's a very British musical, isn't it, Libby? I feel the whole sensibility is thoroughly British. It'll be interesting to know if it's from Travels, like other Macintosh musicals.
Well, I really loved it, I think it will travel. I think it will go everywhere. There is just a terrific warmth about it, and it should also be said that as well as this rather clever way in which they've kept little bits of Alan Bennett. And in fact, there's one lyric which, if Alan Bennett had ever written lyrics, he would have written, you know, he says, "What kind of man are you?" And he sings, "The kind who would like children but doesn't press the point. The kind who lets you make decisions then agrees they're joint." You know, I mean, that, if Alan Bennett wrote lyrics, that's what Alan Bennett would write. And so it's sort of, he's woven into it, yet it's warmer than Bennett and it's bouncier. It's a real musical. And I think we ought to say how incredibly well served it is by both the very restrained production, because Richard Aird milks nothing, everything just moves on very quickly, and by the choreography. Mm. I mean, I actually fell off my seat virtually at the sight of Prince Philip, the young Prince Philip, dancing a soft shoe shuffle with his hands behind his back. You know, it's just witty all the way through and lovable. I mean, we came up literally purring after a rather difficult week.
Just on the choreography, Mrs. Spencer made a rare appearance at the theatre with me last night.
And she's a ballet dancer.
And she was absolutely loved the choreography. She's absolutely classical in her tradition, but she just thought it was so inventive.
Stephen Meyer is very, very clever.
He really is, really. I think he's the top.
The
top
big scene, choreo. I mean, they've inserted a big flashback scene, which is not bent, of how the couple meet in a wartime dance hall, which is then wrecked in an air raid. And that is stunning. I mean, to have all the Lindy Hop going on and this big spectacular thing, you're really not expecting the air raid. You're not expecting this poignant moment afterwards. And you just think, oh, they're so clever, they can do everything with my emotions. Everything, we're safe.
The music is brilliant, sort of pastiche 40s. And it's got the sort of dance band flavours.
Yeah, the Jitterbug, the Andrews Sisters.
Some of the numbers almost feel like novelty numbers. It's great stuff.
But then also, because we've just come out, and we'll be talking about it later, of the early 40s and Flair Park and the wartime, the row of three women, wartime wives or widows with bad feet, just waiting for the chiropodist and singing, you know, he has magic fingers, he has magic hands, somehow I know he understands. And it's the only little bit of comfort and luxury they're getting is to have their corns done. And it was moving, and you just weren't expecting that in the first few minutes of a bouncy show with an animatronic pig in it.
I mean, that's what's interesting about this show is the terrain it occupies, because we're always told that musicals thrive on one topic singly, which is showbiz. It's musicals about show business. And of course, there is this component to it, and Sarah Lancashire's sort of thrilling sense of somebody that she might be if she could just don a shimmering sequin dress and let rip. And Sarah Lancashire, who I've only ever seen once before in the West End, is, I'm sorry to say, a not very good Miss Adelaide in Gauze and Dolls, is just sensational in this. But on the other hand, it occupies the terrain of calluses and bunions and corns and lots of flatulence. And you think this is all rather new territory.
And all that, we haven't mentioned the pig.
Well, exactly, and thereby hangs my problem with it, is that unlike Billy Elliot, which you can root for a real boy, rooting for an animatronic pig, for me, doesn't cut the mustard.
But you're not meant to be rooting for the pig. You root for the husband, surely.
Well, you don't want him... want the pig to have its throat slit. I wanted this pig to be its throat to be slit immediately.
But the show isn't about the pig.
No, the pig...
I think it's the X factor in the show. Yes. Every musical needs an X factor, doesn't it? That some whoosh, and when that pig comes on and grins at the audience,
it's magical. They've made a big PR thing of the pig, but really, the pig is just sort of... It's the cherry on the cake, really, is. I mean, and I want to go back to Sarah Lancashire, because what she's doing there is she's rather brilliantly channeling Raquel the barmaid that she used to play in Coronation Street, who also had ideas above her station, and she wanted to learn to speak a bit of French and so on. And suddenly that's all back. And so in a sector of the audience, there's a kind of big memory, which is separate from the Maggie Smith memory in the film and pushes it all on. The whole thing is just...
Although, actually, she does channel Maggie Smith perfectly in her speech.
But without it becoming too parodic.
Yeah, yes.
Because that could be, you know, 2.5 hours of that nasality could be very irritating. One very clever thing I thought about it, and nowadays all musicals are self-referential, as we know, or at least referential within the context of their creators, and there are these little bits threaded through it where Cameron McIntosh and Richard Eyre pay homage to previous McIntosh productions. There's a reference to Pa from Oliver. At the end of the first act, they're all sort of bearing placards that say, no bread rations, more meat, and they're moving about in a kind of Les Mis style shuffle.
Yes.
But it's gently done. It doesn't hit you over
and
the head.
And Mr. Wormald, I noticed that too. I'm so happy you said that, because I noticed the bit of, you know, let the people free from Les Mis. But Mr. Wormald...
Well, it's Javert and Valjean, isn't it?
The meat inspector. He's Javert, but he's also Phantom of the Opera. When he pulls his gauntlets off, you sort of think, oh, you know, all Cameron's life is here, and Cameron's getting old, and God bless Cameron.
I also thought, didn't you think in the bit about the painting, there's a bit of Sondheim's. It's very,
yes.
I'm sure there's echoes of Finishing the Hat.
Yes. The one thing we haven't mentioned is Anne Emery, who for me absolutely steals the show. She stole the show in Billy Elliot to some extent, and she actually did that show for about 5 years of its run. She is now 83, 1 year short of the character she is playing, and has so much energy. And, you know, that's a role created on film by Liz Smith. And she's just wonderful.
I think she could become the new Thora Hird. I mean, when she says that line about her, you know, the mother-in-law line, well, we know that you're a thudding disappointment and your husband's a cretin, but I think we can all live together. That's life.
From one period musical to another, The Umbrellas of Cherbourg is not, strictly speaking, a new show, since the stage version of this 1964 French film musical was previously staged in the West End in the early 80s and quickly floundered at the Phoenix Theatre. This new version, which has come to London by way of an out-of-town tryout at Leicester, is a total reimagining of the material by the Cornwall-based company Knee High, directed by Emma Rice. In a programme note, Rice describes the original film as the essence of chic. Is the stage version that, Matt?
The essence of chic? I don't know about that.
Essence of chic.
Thank you, Charlie. Well, since we're taping this at the National Theatre, one of my sort of desert island performances going way back now, about 2 decades or so, was Joanna Rodding's absolutely beautiful performance of Julie Jordan in Carousel in this building, which I saw several times. And you kind of think, well, how do these women, particularly in the musical theatre, advance their careers? And here she is back on the West End headlining the show alongside a cabaret artiste called Meow Meow, and she's perfectly fine, but to no avail. The problem with it is that it's deeply whimsical, it's deeply synthetic, and Emma Rice doesn't seem to trust that, so she's gussied it up with all this stuff, which only just shows how more synthetic and whimsical it is. For instance, the cabaret artiste who sort of frames the action, comments on the action, climbs over the audience like Roberto Benigni on Oscar night, and then sort of proceeds to present what we're watching. It makes no sense, because that woman would never be watching that show.
Yeah.
So the entire conceit is a fraud.
Of course, Emma Rice has succeeded far better with other film adaptations.
Oh, yes.
Brief Encounter, notably, which went from London to Broadway. And also, indeed, in this building, A Matter of Life and Death, which divided critics, but actually I quite liked. Libby, did you take to Umbrellas of Cherbourg?
No, I absolutely didn't. I was desperately disappointed after Brief Encounter. I went to worship, and, you know, that bit where you sort of walk sadly out of the theatre thinking, oh, hell. You know, Meow Meow, who frames it, the chanteuse, is brilliant. And the trouble is that her big song, which she does as an entr'acte, C'est la vie, absolutely wipes the floor with the rest of the show, because she is terrific. But I think I know what the problem is. It is that the script of the original film is very tightly protected. And Meow Meow, I think Emma Rice probably wanted Meow Meow to be making a lot of comments throughout it, to be shrugging in the corner and saying, oh, les jeunes, pof. All she gets to do is hold up a thing at the end saying, c'est la vie, and to do the little speech that at the beginning. I think the original intention got bent at some stage because they were not allowed to mess about with the dialogue. I heard this afterwards,
yeah.
And it sort of solidified my problem with it. And I just think it is kind of a load of empty whimsy, beautifully and interestingly staged, but you can't care about these people. And the only bit, the young couple, the only bit of real passion that you hear in the whole thing is when the garage owner is shouting at him for forgetting to change the oil in someone's car. And you suddenly think, ah, some real feeling here.
And it is, of course, very oddly written. I mean, it's got these as in the film, these kind of everyday lyrics, words, just imposed randomly on the notes. And these new lyrics by Sheldon Harnick, written for a New York production, don't really work.
No. I mean, it's got one big tune, hasn't it? Which is, I've now forgotten the name of it. Such a big
I Will
one.
Wait For You.
I Will Wait For You.
Which is reprised endlessly.
It comes round again and again. Because it is the only tune in it. I mean, the rest of it is the equivalent of a sort of musical version of recitative in an opera. And it really gets on your nerves after a while. And also, what they're saying is pretty banal. And there's very little wit. But I think there was a sort of terrible flatness about it all. I felt watching it that cast knew it was doomed somehow. It just didn't ring and all ring true. And all the, you know, it was nicely designed, all those little model French buildings and the neon. And it, but it was so desperately trying to be sweet and lovable and just somehow wasn't, I thought.
It also doesn't know whether to play itself straight. And it seems to me you have to kind of fix some sort of perspective. So we're told at the beginning Cherbourg is the French equivalent of Hull. And there are all these kind of japes where it seems to be undercutting what the thing itself is, but then since most of it is the thing itself, why are you then undercutting what we're being asked to watch?
But Miao Miao was meant to be doing that, I'm almost certain, you know, that she is a Weimar-y sort of Weimar wannabe.
Yeah, she's coming from cabaret.
And she's from cabaret, and when she does it, and you have this thing that, you know, her line would be, well, you know, he goes away, you know, you've got a baby, you're going to marry someone else, the hell with it. But that doesn't come through in the main story. So the main story is at war with its framing, yes. And the whole thing just felt dislocated and sort of sad.
Is it like the notice has gone up already?
The notice has gone up. It's going to, well, it may not even survive that long, but it's due to close in the middle of May. So now we move on to two new plays by one English playwright and one American, both of whom are very prolific, Simon Stevens and Neil LaBute. Turning first to Wastwater by Simon Stevens, that has opened at the Royal Court under the direction of Katie Mitchell. It's structured as a triptych. It revolves around three sets of couples interacting in the shadow of Heathrow Airport. Libby, I don't think you were a fan of this one.
One of my problems in coming to terms with doing this job is stars, because I don't like to give the one star, which is basically a raspberry, to anything where competent, good actors are giving it their all, and that's what happened in Wastwater. But it's terrible. It's absolutely terrible. It's cold, it's depressing, it's obscure, it's unfelt. It is supposed to be about now and about us round Heathrow now, and it just sort of... there are these three parts to it which are sort of loosely connected, and they're all just packed with stuff that... feels as if Simon Stevens has just hauled out of the papers. Ooh, porn, that's a big thing. Yes, people do awful things in Epping Forest, you know, and in porn scenes, so let's put that in. And, oh yeah, they sell children on Heathrow. Let's put in a 9-year-old Filipino child visa. Well, with no real storytelling, no, you know, with a lot of sort of obscurity and ambiguity, which is supposed to make you think it's clever, but it's not clever. It's just glum and depressing and absolutely without heart. And I think the way it's directed is at times a bit of a disgrace. The scene shifting is brilliant. It's got fastest, most brilliant changes of scene in any play I've ever seen. Stunning. I mean, give them a technical Oscar for that one. But one stage, the character who is selling the child, who's a sort of sadist called Sean, you know, well enough performed, you know, Amanda Hale, she is sitting at the side of the stage on a plastic chair, talking sideways. And I was in row F, and I could just about hear. I think if I was right at the back, I wouldn't have heard. That's not direction. That's kind of disrespect for your audience. Well, I don't like it.
Well, Katie Mitchell is famous for playing everything naturalistically. I mean, people regularly complain at her productions that they can't hear. That's a familiar refrain. I thought six extremely good actors here, but all of whom seem to be wasted.
Yeah, it's a horrible little play, really. It's got, as Libby said, it's got no heart. It's got a sort of self-preening cleverness in the way that, you know, bits of one story emerge from the other. There's a sort of structure, but it's completely at random. Even I, not the most renowned of feminists, finds it hard to stomach a play where, for no reason at all, the woman asks to be hit, which is given no justification. And also, I thought he was playing particularly nasty games in the last one, which is the sort of most shocking of the three pieces, where it's where all the indications are that this is a man obtaining a child for paedophilic purposes, but at the end there's a little bit of doubt about whether that is the case or not. And I thought that was about when I thought, oh God, rot you, you know. I mean, it really is. It's just sort of. It's a man playing games with really serious subject matter and actually just skimming the surface of it. And I found the whole sort of modish production. I do agree that those set changes were about the best I've ever seen.
Can I just say one very quick thing? That was supposed to be about now and us and round Heathrow and so on, and it got nowhere and it said nothing. Upstairs, meanwhile, you know, floors above it at the court, there is a play on which I rather approach with certain dread. It's about present-day political and social tensions in Latvia.
Remembrance Day.
And it's absolutely stunning. you know, and I was totally involved in it, though I know nothing of Latvia. I know a lot of Heathrow, but I wasn't involved in Simon Stevens. I think that means something.
Matt, Simon Stevens has been very prolific of late. I mean, he's had plays here at the National, causing controversy. He's had plays at Lyric Hammersmith Punk Rock. He can write.
He wrote one of my favourite plays, actually, in recent years at the World Court with Daniel Mays, who we saw just recently in Moonlight, which was a play called Motortown, which I thought was absolutely terrific. But this play is a puzzle play, and I often resent puzzle plays if I think they're playing unfairly with the spectator. Pinter, at his best, writes brilliant puzzle plays, preeminently Betrayal, where the whole thing is told in reverse chronology, and what you need to do is sort of pick particular moments, gestures, lines, sequences, and piece them together. This, we discover only from reading the text, that the first scene takes place after the subsequent scenes to no particular purpose.
I thought that might be a misprint, indeed, when I saw that, so I didn't even write about it.
You think, why? And then there are sort of threads, oral threads and visual threads that link the three. But to what avail? It seems to be one of these plays that was written to prove a pre-existing point about human behavior. So then you find three diptychs to make that point clear. And I think that's exactly the wrong way round to write a play.
He says in an interview that he is exploring the nihilism and brutality that underlies all human intimacy. And we all look around our homes and say, no, it doesn't.
Well, and the last one of the three, which I think Charlie alluded to, seemed to me particularly specious. It actually seemed, we'll get to this in a minute, a little bit like a forerunner of a Neil LaBute play, because here you have this guy, Angus Wright, who's come to take this young girl for sexual purposes, for parental purposes, you're not quite sure, it's never really explained, but it's so over the top, his sort of fear, his cringing. You think, well, actually, in real life, I have a feeling that's probably exactly what it wouldn't be.
Yeah.
And also, why is the woman who is the vendor of this girl so horrible?
Yeah.
She wouldn't be that either. It seems completely spurious.
In terms of the structure, a previous play he wrote was actually written, apparently the scenes could be performed in any order. I think that was Pornography. And the interesting thing about Simon Stevens is and indeed Kate Mitchell's, they work a lot in Europe, particularly in Germany, where they like these sorts of things.
I can see that. That says it all.
The other thing to be said about both of them, actually, is they're both really nice people, oddly enough.
But great sets. I honestly think the sets could be a contender for year-end awards.
Yes.
They are brilliant.
Well, they were uncanny, weren't they?
They
were quite see
so
how they brought them in so quickly
fully. I was in the second row, so I could hear the actors, but I couldn't hear the sets.
Oh.
And you thought, how did those sets fall into place? It was dazzling.
Yeah.
Wasted money.
Finally, in this section, Neil LaBute seems to turn our plays faster than Alan Ayckbourn. While the Armida, which regularly produces his work, has his most recent Broadway play, Reasons to be Pretty, opening later in this year, the West End has offered the world premiere of In a Forest Dark and Deep, a play in which Matthew Fox plays a brother helping his older sister, played by Olivia Williams, to clear out a holiday cottage. But all is not what it seems as the evening unravels. Charlie, have you been a fan of Neil LaBute in the past? And I know you're not a fan of this one.
I've quite liked some of them, though none of them I've found repay a second viewing. They're sort of rather old-fashioned, the play with a twist, almost all of them. This one, when you said everything is not as it seems, my problem was that everything was exactly as it seemed, and I could see the twist coming 20 minutes into an hour and 40-minute play.
Yeah.
It's pretty terrible, this one. It's very windy in the dialogue. Neither of the characters huff and puff and lot, but they don't actually register with me as being individual creations. They're just types. You've got the sort of intelligent schoolteacher, but rather unpersuasively promiscuous sister, and the sort of roughneck blue-collar brother. Both of them seem like sort of drawn from stock, and the twists, as I say, are completely predictable. And it's just a lot of noise and shouting, and really, really poor, and doesn't have that normal sort of sudden shock that LaBute does.
Of course, it is very unusual for us to have a brand new play in the West End at all. I think for that, we should applaud it a little.
Oh, I don't know. There's no reason to be sentimental just because somebody decided to put on a play. I mean, I think the thing about Neil LaBute is that actors like it because it's meaty, or it's sort of faux meaty, and you feel as if you're Matthew Fox and you've had great success on television, here's an opportunity to really let rip. But it all is so much shouting in the wind, as Charlie has said, and rather like Simon Stevens, except I think it's a little more noxious with Neil LaBute because it's almost become a formula. It's let's begin with the twist and work backwards. And it usually involves lovers who've soured or siblings who have some secret. I remember seeing Reasons to Be Pretty in New York, and there was, during the performance, a spectator in the seventh row who stood up and started hurling abuse at the cast. And I, to this day, am convinced that was a plant, and that that was part of the Labutian method. Because otherwise, there isn't actually much organic, genuine drama.
And Charlie said that I was talking about Simon Stevens being a very nice guy. Neil Labute is also a very nice guy. It's fascinating that all this darkness is in there.
I liked it actually more than either of you did, because I found it quite gripping. And I was thinking kind of, God bless America, you know, because when an English playwright wants to be clever and nihilistic and cynical like Simon Stevens, you know, he doesn't mind giving you a really thoroughly nasty evening. Whereas actually this was quite gripping. I wanted to know what was going on. And I thought there was an interesting theme in it, not much developed, but sort of interesting, which was a kind of two eras of America, in that you had the chap was a sort of redneck, you know, rough, violent character, you know, from straight out of True Grit.
Yeah.
And he was actually the virtuous one, and the modern kind of liberal arts lecturer at a college was actually far nastier. And I just thought that was an interesting thing to do, and it could have been better done. But I have to say, I sat there kind of gripped the whole way through, and that's you know, you don't know as much more in the theatre, but it was basically, it was a telly play.
It's funny, Libby, that you say right out of True Grit, because when I was watching, I was thinking right out of True West, except
yes.
That those are two brothers, and this is a brother and a sister, and I kept thinking, gosh, if Sam Shepard had explored this, it would seem real somehow, as opposed to ersatz. I also felt sorry for Olivia Williams, who has to play a role that doesn't actually make a lot of sense conceptually, where it's revealed as the play goes on that she has this deeply promiscuous past, and yet she seems all tight and buttoned up, and the guy who's kind of crude and rugged and is a layabout, but he's actually more moral.
I don't think you've hung around enough liberal arts departments in American universities. That woman made absolute sense to me. I recognised her totally. But it was I thought it was well performed, and as I say, it gripped me. I think if I'd been paying for my seat, I'd have been a bit narky about it, but it wasn't that bad.
On that note, for this section, thank you, Matt, Libby and Charlie.